The river was ours. Chapter 1. Shiny Flex. I called her Nicknay, the Nissenin word for mother. She had kind eyes and chocolate brown hair that was shiny and strong. Her hands were equally strong, a sign of hard work. Despite calluses in the center of her palms, her fingertips were wrinkly from bathing in the cool river. She'd press her fingers against mine and I'd laugh. When she spoke, her tone was firm but gentle. I remember the day she gave me a black arrowhead. She tied a rope made of elk skin around its edges and then around my neck. It hung like a raindrop just below my collarbone with sides slightly uneven. I pressed it to my lips, kissing the surface. The treasure belonged to my father, my Nicktay, who died when I was 6. If he were here, he would know how to help with everything that was about to unfold. In the blink of an eye, it seemed, the river that was ours would no longer represent courageousness, acceptance, and peace, but become wastewater as the earth around it fell to the sound of the axe. Back then, the river felt safe. The first time I heard the word gold, it echoed against the backdrop of hills and trees, surrounded by blue skies and fluffy white clouds. A man's voice startled me awake. The year was 1848, though I didn't know that then. I only knew that a man named James Marshall worked at the sawmill along the American River in a place called Coloma, California. Another man, John Sutter, owned the mill. Their names didn't mean anything to me, and I thought the clothes they wore looked funny. One day, Marshall was checking the mill race, what the miners called the water channel, when he spotted shiny flecks in the water. Word traveled fast after that. Gold! People shouted, as if the whole world had suddenly changed. What's so great about shiny flecks anyway? I wondered, scratching the feather in the back of my hair. Can you cook them over a bed of hot coals like steelhead trout? I was hungry. I could feel my teeth scraping tender, soft bits of fish off the bone. The events that followed are almost a blur. People speaking a language I didn't understand. Tents set up that looked like makeshift houses, and the smell of greed resembling a deviant smile that curled up on someone's face like smoke in the sky. I walked barefoot down to the river, the Aki Him, and scooped my hands into the water as though I wanted a drink. This time, however, it was muddy, polluted, and clogged with mining debris. The fishing spot I once called home vanished before my eyes. The solitude of the river gave way as gunshots and wagons thundered upon the land. I saw strangers with shovels, wheelbarrows, and pans used for swirling dirt and water to separate gold. Diseases began to spread. Game animals such as rabbits and squirrels were fewer and farther in between. Acorn groves were cut for lumber, and surrounding villages were pushed aside or destroyed. Poor sanitation, crowded camps, and contaminated water became a breeding ground for measles, smallpox, and influenza. From where I sat, I saw a man wearing leather suspenders and boots with heavy cleats. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up to his elbows, and his round cheeks had smears of charcoal and ash. He clutched his stomach as though he were in pain. I remembered my father, my Nicktay. The night he died, he clutched his stomach, too. More about that later, I thought. As salmon dried on racks near our village, I yawned. I sat beside the dome-shaped house made of willow branches and grass thatch. "Come inside," I heard a voice say. It was my Nicknay. The floor was lined with deerskin as I crawled up onto her lap. "Nicknay?" I asked. "Yes." "Will our village be destroyed too?" She smiled, pointing at the small indoor hearth close to my younger brother, my Nisal. I felt its warmth. "Count your blessings," she said with a twinkle in her eye.
Ahem.
Chapter 2. Acorns and Answers. The air smelled different than I remembered. The early morning fog rolled in unannounced. There was a damp odor that resembled rotting tree bark and that sick miner's cough, which rattled like a snake. The man's haggard-looking skin was stained with filth and freckles. I imagined his lips smelled of salted pork and bacon bits. I loved pork, but the thought of eating it only reminded me more of sickness and death. Had the man passed away? I wondered. I couldn't help but think of my father. Maria, my nickname started to say, will you help me gather some acorns? Instead, I wanted to stay inside with my narrow fingers pointing at the hearth as though I were harvesting its warmth. Have you ever slept for 8 hours and it feels as though you could sleep for another 8 more? This wasn't a sickness kind of tired. It felt peaceful, as though I were safe from all destruction. Inside the dome-shaped structure, I could think, feel, and breathe freedom from a chaotic world, a world that shouted uncertainty and shook me to my core. It felt like an earthquake inside my chest. Part of me was living through it, and an entirely separate me was watching the upheaval unfold like a ceremony of some sort, one dipped in gold. For a second, I pictured the entire river turning gold. Could you drink the gold? What did it taste like? Would the fish turn gold too? I questioned. I didn't dare disobey my nickname. Coming, nickname, I said. I put one hand over my mouth, muffling a long, exaggerated yawn. From the outside, the world wasn't all bad. Some parts of the gold rush felt new and full of possibilities. I grabbed a basket for collecting acorns and headed down the dirt path. The trees I passed had familiar faces that seemed to breathe effortlessly, as though it were the calm at the end of a storm. I held my nickname's hand. I looked up. Our eyes met. Nickname, I said, if you had to pick a favorite tree, which one would you choose? She thought for a moment. This one. She pointed to a large oak tree. It had a twisted trunk and branches that seemed to sing in the wind. That was the funny thing about nature. I wanted to laugh at the tree's oddly shaped trunk. I wanted to tell stories about how it resembled my father's gimpy leg, the one he injured on that fateful night. But I would never laugh at my father. I loved my father. I missed my father. Most importantly, I held my father close to my heart. I wore his arrowhead around my neck. Nature had a way of making me smile and reflect at the same time. I counted the acorns as I scooped them into my basket. My brother, my Nisau, skipped over pebbles in the sand. Every so often on the worn path, he picked one up, and into his pocket it went. It grew heavier. His clothes were lopsided from the weight of the stones. I giggled. This time, however, I wasn't laughing at my brother. I was laughing with my brother. He was laughing, too. Before long, we fell to the ground, rolling around in dirt and sand. There was gravel in between my toes. I dropped my basket of acorns. They spilled out, tumbling softly over bumps in the road. Our nickname couldn't help but smile. It was a crooked smile, but a smile nonetheless. She shook her head. Chapter 3. The Stowaway. Laughter faded as I knelt to gather acorns scattered across the path. I squinted, my eyes searching for a shape they might have formed. A star? A moon? A sun? It was hard to tell. The crimson sky bled for miles, it seemed. I looked down. What's this? I whispered to myself, reaching for an object among the acorns and dusting it off. It was small but heavy. I held it in the palm of my hand, trying to make out the words etched on its surface. Our love is locked. Nisao, come here. Look what I found, I exclaimed. I didn't understand the meaning of those words. He scurried over, the sound of pebbles clanking against each other with each step he took. Together we scrutinized the object. What could it be? A tool of some sort? Jewelry? I wondered. It had rounded corners, a smooth, flat bottom, and a jagged hole in the center that looked almost like a missing puzzle piece. Let's take this to the river and wash it, he said, his eyes growing wide with excitement. I nodded, clutching it inside my nubby fist. I respected the river, the Aki Him. It was a place for prayer and kept me close to my ancestors. I had a responsibility to protect Mother Earth. Did Mother Earth feel sad about the destruction the miners had caused to the river? I wondered. The glow of the mid-morning sun bounced off the water. I sighed, recalling the ceremony held at the riverbank after my father, my Nikte, passed away. I was having a flashback. His ashes were entrusted to the river. My Nikne wept as my brother, my Nisao, tugged softly at the fringes of her dress. The flashback ended. I looked around. Carefully, I opened my fist. I set the treasure under the water's surface and began to wash it, rinsing away dirt and debris. At first, it was hard to see. The water was still murky from gold mining. I rubbed the treasure, hard, until my thumb was cramping. I let up. My Nisao leaned over, tiny wisps of hair dangling in his face. Water began splashing onto his toes. Almost there, he blurted. I needed the encouragement. I tried to be brave, but I felt knots in my stomach. I tried to untie them, but they wouldn't budge. I rubbed my eyes. I squinted. I imagined the river on a stormy afternoon, roaring and churning. Well, what does it say? He asked before the sun's warmth had dried the water stains from its surface. He stood up, shaking hair away from his forehead. Sweat dripped off the tip of his nose. I can't read the words, I said with a hint of disappointment. He rested one arm over my shoulder. He shook his head. Neither can I. What's next? Don't know. You think we should ask our Nikne? Probably. I miss our Nikte. Me too. He always knew what to do. Chapter 4, Jagged Holes. More than anything, I wanted to know what those words meant. There was a hunger, a thirst, and a yearning to understand what was engraved on its surface. The surface with rounded corners, a flat bottom, and a jagged hole in the center, resembling a missing puzzle piece. The hole looked almost like the chunk of skin the bullet removed from my father's leg. It was a double-barrel shotgun loaded with black powder. A cloud of white smoke seemed to swallow the timberline slopes. The miners were hunting game animals for food when the accident happened. They rushed to his side. A doctor in town removed the bullet, but there were complications. Eventually, my Nikte lost his leg. I closed my eyes. There it was, the heat of infection and the smell of rotting flesh as though it were yesterday. My Nikte grew feverish, clutching his stomach as my Nikne poured cool water over his face. The shaman, our spiritual leader, used herbal medicines and performed rituals. My Nikne prayed to Great Spirit and the river, the Aki Him. I opened my eyes. I had forgotten what was in my hand. The longer I held it, the less I was aware of its weight. But it was there. It was like the weight of grief. The longer I carried it, the less I was aware of its weight. But it, too, was there. unlike the physical weight of river water being carried in a stone bowl back to the village where I lived. Grief had a way of sneaking up on me. I'd see my Nickne with her hand over her forehead, trying to manage two children, cooking meals, and other tasks that at times seemed mundane to me. My Nisau stood beside me, staring at the ground, wiggling his toes, thumb wrestling behind his back. Had he lost interest in the thing? You know, the thing with rounded corners, a flat bottom, and a jagged hole in the center. It didn't have a name. Perhaps he wanted to race me back to our village, only to see who the fastest runner was. Was he thumb wrestling behind his back to get stronger so he could eventually challenge me to a thumb wrestling war? I wasn't interested in running or thumb wrestling. I was interested in the thing with rounded corners, a flat bottom, and a jagged hole in the center. I was also wrestling with my own thoughts. Do I tell my Nickne? Do I keep it or return it to its rightful owner? Do I follow a path that might lead to more heartache? But no matter how hard I thought, nothing would bring my father, my Nickne, back to life. Nothing would take that jagged hole in the center of my mysterious finding, the one I had nicknamed The Thing, either because it didn't have a name or because I was afraid to give it one and suddenly make it smooth. I had to make peace with it, with its jagged hole that resembled the missing piece of a jigsaw puzzle, the way I had to make peace with the river, the Aki hymn, despite the changes I had witnessed since the start of the gold rush. In the flash of a gold pan, I was faced with the most important decision of them all. How could I fit into a world that wasn't fit for me? Chapter 5. The Big Question. I couldn't stop thinking about the big question, the one that made me stop and breathe, the one that made me try and slow the pace of life despite how quickly everything around me was moving and changing. How could I fit into a world that wasn't fit for me? It was a lot to process. Language barriers built an invisible wall between the Americans and me. Additionally, land symbolized home, relationship, and responsibility for my people. For Americans, land was property. Water was nothing more than the American river, a tool for mining, transport, profit. For my people, it was Aki him, shared, observed, respected. With one arm extended, I handed my Nisau the basket of acorns, careful not to release my grip of the thing. I clutched it tightly in my other hand, so tightly that my knuckles grew pale. They looked almost like snow caps. "Help me carry these back to the village," I said. "Okay. Do you have the..." "Right here." I held my nubby fist in plain sight so he could see. "Let me hold it." "Wait till we get back to..." "Oh, come on." "That's not such a good idea." "I'll be careful, I promise." My fist had become a fort, a secret fort, guarding the thing with all its might. Was this my crossover into unknown territory, the part where I admit I had become just like an American, claiming ownership of the thing in the way Americans claimed ownership of land and just about everything else? I didn't hate Americans, but I didn't want to be like them either. When the Americans helped my father, my Nickne, they were given a chance to help the environment, too. Instead, they hurt the environment. I stopped to catch my breath. I leaned forward with one hand on my knee, huffing. I saw my Nisau up ahead. "Wait up!" I called. He didn't stop. Instead, he tiptoed as if he were stepping on molten cracks. I absorbed stillness as the earth around us seemed to slow with the pace of each footstep. Tiny, meaningful footsteps, the kind that made me stop and think of the big question, how could I fit into a world that wasn't fit for me? The question stung like I imagined the bullet stung when it pierced my father's flesh. It was too soon to answer it. With one foot in front of the other, I began walking back to the village. Chapter 6, The Secret Fort. I felt my nails dig into my palm the longer I held my fist shut. Rain turned the ground beneath my feet to mud. The village was quiet. I imagined wearing soft-soled moccasins handmade of plant fibers. They were delicate and special. I pretended not to soak them in the rainwater pooling in crevices along the path. Then I remembered I was barefoot. I was faced with nothing but the cold, harsh reality of plunging my heels down into the earth that bubbled and breathed and buried me like quicksand. I heard a voice. I looked around as though I were uncertain as to where it had come from. My nickname's shadow appeared. "Maria? Is that you?" she asked. I nodded. "Nickname?" I said. "I have something to show you." For a moment, it looked like all I had to show was my nubby fist, the one I had deemed a secret fort, protecting the thing. Without it, who knows what might happen to those rounded corners, that flat bottom, and the jagged hole resembling the missing piece of a jigsaw puzzle. It was more than the sum of all its features. It was a treasure, and I was entrusted to its care. I tried to release my grip, but my hand was cramping. The more people knew about the secret fort, the sooner they would find out what was inside it. Slowly, I peeled back the layers, one finger at a time, until I could almost see the thing. I wanted the world to know about it. I wanted to return it to its rightful owner. I closed my eyes, fearing that if I so much as looked at the thing, my eyesight alone might damage its exterior. Could I trust my nickname? I wanted nothing more than for her to see inside my fist. My nubby fist, the one I had deemed a secret fort. I wanted her to tell me what to do next. The rain stopped. The mud seemed to turn into bricks. The remaining water became a rainbow that trickled across the gravel road. My nickname wiped acorn mush from her hands. She pulled a thick black braid over her shoulder, squeezing rainwater from the ends. She leaned in, inspecting the thing with her amber-colored eyes. I stood there, awaiting her response, still afraid of looking at that which I held in the palm of my hand. I heard the stone song, a low, coarse sliding and a thump drag as villagers nearby ground acorns using a mortar hole or stone mono. Chapter 7. Iron, Earth, and the Thing. It needed a name, but I wasn't ready to give it one. Not just yet, anyway. I wasn't even sure what the thing was. The iron thing. The cold, rusty, sour-smelling thing. The single thing that seemed unbreakable in a world breaking all around me. My Nisau couldn't help but wonder. If you licked its surface, did it have a bitter aftertaste? Would your tongue stick to its surface? If so, would you talk with a lisp? I imagined the wind lifting me up off the ground and carrying me away. Suddenly, the thing didn't feel heavy enough to anchor me to earth. "Wait. Don't tell me," I said, looking my nickname in the eyes. "I don't want to know." She smiled. I had a feeling I was going to find out one way or another. "It's a padlock," she said. "A padlock?" I repeated. I decided I wasn't comfortable calling it by its real name. Perhaps it should stay the thing forever. "Yes, Americans use these locks to hold two things together. Like what? I asked. She thought for a moment, recalling what she had seen of the American camp the day Doc operated on my father's leg. Let's say a white man travels to Sutter's Mill with his belongings in a treasure chest, she began. A padlock would be looped through an iron latch to keep them safe. Oh, that's right. Where is the key? Good question. Do you suppose someone is missing their belongings right now? You know, without the padlock keeping them safe? It was awkward hearing myself say the word out loud. I hope not. Same. That would be awful. She shuddered. Nickney, I said, tell me a story. What kind of story? She wondered. A make-believe one. All right. I'm ready. King Louis the... No, not a king, I corrected. Then who? A gold miner, I said. A gold miner? Yes. Once upon a time, she began. Too boring, I interrupted. Once upon a stormy night. Too scary. A chill ran down my spine. Let's see now. I interrupted again. I was bossy, curious, and protective. What color was his hair? What color were his eyes? How tall was he? What clothes did he wear? She put her finger to her lips. His hair was dirty blonde. He had eyes as blue as the river. He was tall like Doc, the white man who operated on your father. How tall was Doc? Tall, but not nearly as tall as an oak tree. It would look sort of silly if someone were that tall. I giggled at the thought. She continued, he wore leather suspenders and boots with heavy cleats. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up to his elbows, and his round cheeks had smears of charcoal and ash. He clutched his stomach as though he were in pain. In the flash of a gold pan, the story was no longer make-believe. I dismantled the walls of my secret fort. The man, I thought. The one I saw from the American camp on the other side of the river. That's him! The padlock must have belonged to him. He was sick. Doc must have operated. Doc knows what happened to the man. I turned to my Nisau. We have to find him, I shouted. Find who? He asked. Doc! We have to find Doc! Chapter 8, Pans, Pores, and Profit. Gold! Gold! Gold from the American River! A man named Sam Brannan shouted from the streets of San Francisco, California. Newspapers were tossed about at every corner with headlines announcing Gold Fever and Strike It Rich! The once quiet city was now a whirlwind of chaos and confusion. Very few people paused to think about the cost of the gold rush, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Instead, there was the squeak of wagon wheels bumping and grinding on the gravel road. Hawks circled over mining camps in the warm air. Gold coins pinged as they spun and twirled and whirred like a top. At Sam Brannan's mercantile, shovels, picks, and gold pans lined the shelves beside luxuries such as coffee, sugar, tobacco, and whiskey. He was an entrepreneurial man who had sideburns and a goatee, with hair slicked back in the center and remaining wisps tickling the tops of his ears. He wore a straight-lipped expression that was neither considerate of nor cruel toward nature or mankind. That's $2 in gold dust, he said as the customer, a man with sweaty, enlarged pores, handed over a loaf of bread and a pinch of gold. He set the bread aside and placed the gold dust on the scale behind the counter. 10 cents, the man said, disbelieving. That's what a loaf cost before all this. He rubbed his eyes with the back of his hand. He spit on the ground while chewing a thick wad of tobacco. Sunlight pierced the window. The man's shirt scooped up at the bottom, exposing his soft belly. He had a taut forehead, rounded shoulders, and fat, swollen ankles glowing purplish red. He scratched his mustache, his fingernails stained from a long, hard day's work. I'll see you tomorrow, Sam, the man said, looking him square in the eyes. Chapter 9. What Doc Knew. Be careful now, our Nick-Nay said, as my niece-ow and I headed toward the American camp to find Doc. The world beyond the river is not ours. Then she handed my niece-ow and me a small acorn cake wrapped in a large oak leaf. In case you get hungry on your journey, she added. I wanted to take a bite, sinking my teeth into the chewy treat with its nutty aroma. My niece-ow sniffed the air. He licked his lips. He wanted a bite, too. Our Nick-Nay shook her head. You must save it for the journey, she said firmly. I nodded. My niece-ow nodded. Together we nodded. The land itself was our guide. There were worn trails and places where many feet had crossed before ours. We knew the river's bends, where the water slowed or narrowed, and the slope of the land. Most importantly, we knew which side of the river meant home. The question wasn't, how do I get back? The question was, how could I not? Looking across the river at the Aki Him, I could see the American camp. Still, it seemed so far away. My legs were restless, though I hadn't gone more than 10 steps from the village. I paused. My niece-ow turned his head. Aren't you coming? He asked, looking over his shoulder. Once again, I nodded. This time, however, I felt the muscles in my neck tighten. It felt as though I had made a promise I didn't intend to keep. My neck was knotting without my permission. I remembered my niece-ow's description of Doc. Tall, but not nearly as tall as an oak tree. A beaver felt hat. Round spectacles. That could be anyone. I was sure there were at least 100 other men who fit that description. Finding Doc was going to be harder than I thought. We approached Sutter's Mill and were met with moldy corn. Little white tufts stuck to the ears. I couldn't help but think of the shaman's white hair from our village back home. Wilted stalks were tri-colored, a blur of green, yellow, and brown. I remembered my father's gimpy leg, the one he could no longer stand on. His muscles grew tired and weak, weeping as though they were a neglected crop. Here, corn kernels were as dark as nightfall and hard like toasted acorns. I imagined that warm summer evening when the cockroaches invaded our village. I heard the sound of my niece-ow's bare feet smashing their crunchy shells. Could he smash corn kernels, too? I wondered. I heard the clanging of horses' hoofs as the freely roaming livestock ate itself into a frenzy. Knock-kneed pigs baked in the open air, beams of early afternoon sunlight frying their fat little bellies. I noticed the hustle of the American camp without stopping to take it all in. My niece-ow and I spoke only a few words of English. We hoped it was enough to get by. We approached the first man in sight, searching for clues he might have. He set his gold pan aside. His eyes scanned ours from head to toe, as if trying to figure out what a couple of young'uns was doing out here all by themselves. Doctor, I said, gesturing with my hands. Where? He leaned in close, cupping his hand behind the back of his ear to amplify sound. We look for doctor, my Nisao clarified. Oh, he pointed to one of the tents. I was relieved. We wouldn't have to walk far. Bristle-like whiskers from barley and wheat grasses nestled at the top of my feet like needles. They jabbed between my toe pads. My Nisao and I wove between pickaxes and other tools scattered on the ground like acorns. Voices drifted toward us from inside a tent, its canvas walls stained from rainwater as the shadow of a tall man inched closer.
And that's what happened to the filler, Doc said, cradling the lock in his hands.
Man, name? I asked. Doc smiled, straightening the brim of his hat. He scratched his chin. The stubble of facial hair resembled a prickly pear cactus from the Sierra Nevada foothills near Coloma. His nails made a scraping sound against the texture of his skin.
Ruff. Thomas Ruff, he said.
He cleared his throat. Chapter 10, A Gentle Joining. Doc sighed. He pulled a handkerchief out of his coat pocket and blew his nose. Measles, he said. It's a hard way to go. He rubbed cigarette ashes on his arm in a dot-like pattern, showing what measles looked like. He pointed to the lock.
Belonged to Mr. Ruff, he said. Worked the river, that feller. Hard. How is it that you folks say it? Aki him?
My Nisao and I nodded. We understood more English than we could speak. Doc brushed the ashes from his arm.
Had a 9-year-old girl, about your age, he said, looking me in the eyes. I reckon she'll appreciate something to remember her old man. She lives not far from here. I'll gladly take you by.
He read the words on the back.
Our love is locked.
He put one hand over his heart. He reached over and placed his other on my Nisao's heart.
Feel that?
He asked.
Thump, thump. Thump, thump. That's how a beaten heart sounds.
I smiled. I rubbed my tongue along the inside of my cheeks. I bit down softly on a chunk of skin, forming a dimple on my left side. The spit in my mouth made gurgling noises. Doc motioned with his hands.
Well then, he said, raising one eyebrow, let's get on.
I pulled my Nisao in close. So close our hearts knocked once, then settled. Fear settled, too. A fear of the unknown. A fear that echoed the big question. How could I fit into a world that wasn't fit for me? The sun almost hid behind hilltops. Just beyond the mill structures, an old brush shelter withstood the land. A woman wiped her apron before stepping off a small stone block and into the last remains of pink sunlight. Can I help you some? She asked. She placed one hand at the top of her forehead, squinting with her beady brown eyes. Dark circles outlined her saggy skin. Doc reached back into his pocket. He turned around.
Got a couple of young'uns with me. Says they found something might be yours, he said,
holding the treasure up high as if he were inspecting it all over again.
This here look familiar?
A day ago, I hardly trusted myself with the treasure, let alone a complete stranger I had never met before now. Suddenly, I was comfortable letting Doc hold it up high, exposing its rounded corners, flat bottom, and that jagged hole in the center to a world that was not my own. Was I subconsciously letting go of the thing, preparing to release it back to its rightful owner? I wondered. Tension in the woman's eyes softened. A little girl came forth,
as if out of nowhere, and shyly hid behind her mother's legs, she squeezed the ends of the cloth apron. Without warning, the answer to the question, the big question, the one that had followed me all this way, came running toward me like a jackrabbit. How could I fit into a world that wasn't fit for me? Perhaps the world didn't need me to change. Perhaps it needed to make room for me. I smiled. The little girl's head protruded like a turtle emerging from its shell. She waved. "I'm Lucy," she said. My head ached. For a moment, I forgot my own name. Maria, I think, I stuttered. "Thank you." For the lock. It was my father's. Nicte? Is that how you say it? She held the key between her thumb and forefinger. Mm-hmm. What's that? She pointed to the acorn cake in my hand. You want? I broke a piece off, holding it out. Lucy hesitated. She looked to her mother for approval, then back at my Nisau and me. She took a bite. Mighty good, she said, chewing. She swallowed. Your Nicte gonna be looking for you? I shook my head. Lucy nodded once. Mine neither.